Live from the 2017 DBA International Conference at the Aria Resort Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas, it's time now for a special episode of the Capital Club Radio Show, broadcasting on the Pro Business Channel Networks. This show made possible in part by Flock Specialty Finance. And now, here's your host, Chairman and CEO of Flock Specialty Finance, Michael Flock.
Thank you. And we're delighted today to have a very distinguished guest with us, Bob Morris, the founder and CEO of Oliphant Financial and co-founder of Beam Software. Bob has more than 30 years' experience in financial services. He founded Oliphant back in 1992 with his father, when debt buying was merely an experiment by a few banks. He has bought and sold literally thousands of debt portfolios since. He's also a founding member and past president of the Debt Buyers Association. He created the first published recovery index, and he's the creator of the universal debt browser technology with a U.S. patent. He's also co-founder of Beam Software for debt buyers and collection agencies. Bob has an outstanding resume. He's a true leader and expert in this industry of hundreds of companies. And Bob is really kind of a celebrity in all this because of his history, his expertise. But so, Bob, with a stellar resume like that, you know, what motivated you to get into this space? You know, I mean, you didn't grow up dreaming of being a debt buyer, but what is it in your background? How did you get into this?
Everybody's going to have their own story about how they fell into the business.
You don't have to be politically correct. That's okay.
Well, believe me, I'm not. Okay. In fact, there's some other people not too distant from us right now, and he and I have had some very interesting discussions about recent politics. And as we came in on an international flight the other night into Las Vegas airport, the entire luggage area was empty except for the three of us.
Okay.
And I looked back at him and I said, Trump immigration policies at work.
Okay.
Anyway, so inspiration to get in this business was non-existent. It was a very happenstantial sort of a thing. If you want, I can get into that a little bit.
Okay.
Before there was any structure whatsoever to this business, there was a number of people that were literally going around the country trying to make market for non-performing charged-off loans. And one of the major sellers at the time was offering 90-day terms on repayments. And so this particular gentleman showed up in Sarasota, Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And there were several of us at the time that all started businesses within about a month. And so in February of 92, we got started. This is 25 years today.
Right.
Actually. This is
awesome. Congratulations.
And yeah, thank you. And, you know, the rest is history. We all formed our companies about the same time, and we learned a lot together. But the one thing that we quickly learned was that there was no acceptance from the traditional recovery, the old guard recovery groups that were out there at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't quite know what to make of us, and we were different.
And we wanted. What way were you different?
An agency typically has a 4 to 6 month window to collect on an account. We were looking at the long term, even in the beginning days. We wanted to wait out those situations when they occurred. And so we always, well before CFPB ever became the thing or had any impact on this business, you know, we were very, I think even by today's standards, they'd say we were misleadingly friendly
mm-hmm.
in our letters. But we wanted to immediately differentiate ourselves from being any sort of an old guard agency.
Mm-hmm.
Because we knew that was the experience that they had before, and I like to think that's how this business actually revolutionized
mm-hmm.
the ARM industry.
Mm-hmm. So misleadingly friendly. That's how you.
We weren't misleading. What I'm saying is today it would be interpreted that way, and
okay.
You can't say anything
okay.
today.
Okay.
Without
I'm
the
just seeing if you're listening.
Okay. I'm listening
yeah.
to you.
Okay.
Three cups of coffee. I can't help but hear
okay.
everything, including them.
Okay. Okay.
Okay.
All right. So you started as an agency, and obviously, though, there are very few banks selling at the time, right? It was an experiment. So did you actually start working with some banks to figure out what the best process was for them to sell their loan portfolios or their debt portfolios?
No, we did. We did. We worked closely with them. And
which ones? Anyone in particular you can mention?
HSBC.
Okay.
In fact, a guy by the name of John Matusiak, who recently passed,
okay.
Was the primary selling contact mm-hmm. that we had mm-hmm. out in Salinas, California, mm-hmm. back before their operations went to Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. There was Bank One Capital, mm-hmm. or I'm sorry, Bank One Corp in mm-hmm. Columbus, Ohio, mm-hmm. Which is now somehow folded up into the J.P. Morgan Chase. Mm-hmm. There was Bank America, which I think might claim title have done the very first mm-hmm. debt sale. And then there was the Manny Hanny Manufacturers Hanover, which became Chemical, which is also in the Chase mm-hmm. Lineage now. And so those are really the principal four. And the ensuing years after we formed, we would get a lot of oddball notices coming out of the then RTC. And that's where I met Melody Cuff, of course.
Right.
She was doing a lot of the bank liquidation activity that was being conducted out in Oklahoma City.
That's right.
And
was that when she was working with Bill Bartman?
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. She was her, I think, employee number 23 for Mr. Bartman.
Okay.
So she had been there in the very beginning, but was never part of the primary mm-hmm. Operations that this industry knew, mm-hmm. but rather the bank liquidations that were going on. Mm-hmm. So that was Melody's thing. And in fact, that's why we got together in 95 mm-hmm. as debt sales were coming to an end at the RTC. They mm-hmm. had a sunset sale in December of 95. Melody joined Oliphant about 2 or 3 months before that.
Mm-hmm. So when you first started Oliphant, did you have a technology strategy in mind, or was that focus on technology, did that just evolve as you matured? Because today you're known for kind of being a leading technologist and a proponent of the power of data and information, and that's a big differentiator. And then, of course, you founded Beam later. But did you start thinking about technology way back then, or was that more of a happenstance and just part of the maturity of the business?
No, nah, it's more organic than that. I mean, of course, I'm just old enough and just young enough to have had enough computer training mm-hmm. And so forth in school. Mm-hmm. But it was more of a, I love spreadsheets because of what they can do. And mm-hmm. so I'm self-taught in many ways, mm-hmm. but the technology at the time would look so weak by today's standards.
Mm-hmm. What system did you use then? Was it a homegrown one or?
No, it was ACT. We started with ACT, if you can believe that.
Oh my God.
And that was the first,
that's pretty primitive.
It was the first, I think, 12 months of business. And
okay.
It was, you know, but it did the job. It contained the data. We had to build the superstructures around it to make sure that, protected accounts were protected and
mm-hmm.
so on.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a challenge to work mm-hmm. with.
Mm-hmm. So when did Oliphant start really buying in volume? I mean, you started in 92, but it was, later in that decade, you really ramped up?
Yeah. The whole industry went through a lot of change circa 95 to 98.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And a lot of that was because of the, what I'll call the Bartman effect now, where for the first time at that point in this industry's history, significant Wall Street money was pouring in
mm-hmm.
and the market was still pretty young.
So did you get Wall Street money then?
I did. I had some, and I had a lot ready to go. Mm-hmm. And the CFS phenomena at the time,
right?
As a lot of people will recall, he was on the cover of many magazines and sort of a.
Could you elaborate on that? Because I'm not sure all our listeners might remember what the CFS dilemma means.
Well, he was the first company to
Bartman. Yeah,
Mr. Bartman's company was called Commercial Financial Services right. out of Tulsa, Oklahoma, and had a very good corporate culture by all accounts that I've heard. But they raised money on Wall Street to go mm-hmm. and buy charged off portfolios. But in the end, it fell apart on the economics and they were overpaying for paper. And that's sort of the mm-hmm. retro analysis of it at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And, but there were some good effects and some bad effects during that period of time. The bad effect, of course, was it suffocated the market.
Mm-hmm.
And it really was very difficult to buy anything reasonably.
Mm-hmm. That was in the late 90s?
Yeah, I would say that really starts around 96, 97, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then things ultimately caught up to one another and, that effect disappeared overnight, literally. But the good silver lining of it all was it really brought a lot of market awareness to all of banking and any credit card issuer at the time that hadn't conducted a sale or even, thought of it as a process that they could employ.
Mm-hmm.
They were doing so seriously mm-hmm. at that point. And, I know Melody and I both have talked to a number of banks and
right.
brought them out with their first sales or at least advised on them.
Right.
If we weren't in there trying to buy them. But I think the biggest thing that happened was the qualitative measurements of paper, method of quantifying it and qualifying it as a purchasable asset changed. Bank recovery managers would sell at various stages of the recovery cycle, which means you've got a huge price differential. But as it got closer to the point of charge-off, and therefore closer to the first delinquency, naturally that must employ much more money than what we had been paying, you know, in the early years.
Right. So during that period, when you said you were quantifying and qualifying, I guess, these portfolios, I think that you probably developed some tools along the way, and I don't know that it was a strategy, but it was maybe, you call it organic evolution, I think. What could you share with our listeners then a couple of the things that you did to try to, you did it out of your own need, but I think you institutionalized it, like the universal debt browser. When was that developed? And can you elaborate on the purpose of that and how it was an important asset that you brought to the industry?
Well, I built it as a prototype, and I got about half of the people wanted it, and the other half really didn't.
Okay.
But I knew that the moving and containment of portfolio data was going to become a more sensitive issue. So think of it as kind of like a PDF format for debt portfolios, except with a self-awareness that they would expire and make themselves unusable after a period of time.
Okay.
And that was really the idea, to get something with a lot of security around it. So what I built was a prototype that it was very fast. It would handle a lot of records. And the developer I used was just brilliant. And we did it in about 3 or 4 weeks' time. And we distributed it. We made it free to membership for a number of years. And it actually employed a standard that DBA would have housed. And ostensibly, you'd be trading files in this thing. But the security and the finality of it was never really there at the time. And I don't think there was enough support. I still believe that would be a good solution today. Ideas sometimes take time.
Okay. And you just mentioned DBA, the Debt Buyers Association. You were one of the founding members, and you became president in 2002.
Yes.
And I think I recall you telling, actually, our panel discussion this morning that, you were at the very beginning of the transformation of the industry when we're trying to go from the gunslinger cowboy culture to the consumer-friendly culture. What were some real tangible steps that you took as president to do that?
Obviously, the UDB debt browser was sort of the benchmark of while I was there. But I was always a promoter of having the association itself be and serve as a almost a regulatory body to itself. Stories like what Mike Bendixson told this morning are absolutely true. It's just too easy. Mankind is too capable, almost. It's too easy to commit a fraudulent transaction. Copy replace with other zip codes and phone numbers and dupe somebody out of a lot of money if that person isn't smart enough or has the ability or capability to validate what he's purchasing. And so I still think there's room for that solution.
So we're talking about 2002. So Oliphant then was 10 years old.
Yeah.
And
would have made me 13.
Well, but let's talk to our listeners. Many of our listeners are entrepreneurs, and I know your parents helped you capitalize the company, and you brought in, you said, Wall Street money to help finance debt buying. Could you comment on some of the good times and bad times, the evolution of Oliphant Financial, which is now celebrating its 25th year? It wasn't all bed of roses. Share with us, some of the adverse times, and how did you get through that? You were learning to be you were a founder, but you were also CEO. And what were some of the lessons that you learned from some of the bumps along the way?
Never get caught up in doing one thing, and never have a single client that's too big.
Never get caught up in one thing. Okay.
Be diverse. And so we did do a lot of things, and we did that out of necessity. When supplies ran short during, the late 90s, we focused on evangelizing new people and looking for alternative products. And in fact, we did find some.
Okay.
We focused on brokering and advising.
Okay.
And just,
is that when you had the worldwide debt exchange?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So we created that. We did lots of transactions. and did a lot of work with and for people, and it created other opportunities for co-purchasing as well.
Mm-hmm.
I also spent a lot of time talking to the money people, which is frankly how you and I got together back in the day,
right?
In the early 2000s, and
then
that of course led to the gateway deal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And now I can tell you in all candor, I'd never done anything like that in my life.
Bob, okay. All right. Well, we did all
Sorry
right.
to tell you that on this show.
Well, we like to be transparent, authentic, so I appreciate that admission after how many years? You certainly had me convinced that you knew what you were doing.
No, I mean, I felt comfortable doing it, you know. But
yeah, well, thank you. It was a fun transaction.
I learned a lot.
So what keeps you up, you know, at Oliphant? I know, and frankly, it would be interesting to comment on how the company's evolved since then, because I know you've got a new vision right now, mm-hmm. and we've met some of your new investors, you know, from the UK, and I think you're now kind of going offshore with some of your recovery operations.
Well, we're going to have some of that, but we're going to still be a very diverse organization, very much with a Sarasota presence.
Okay.
But we're going to be doing, you know, more of what we call a master servicer role as well as the debt purchasing. So we see a wide open field of available opportunity
mm-hmm.
When it comes to, you know, what our business activity is going to be over the next couple of years. Debt purchasing is, you know, always going to be a core.
That's your core business, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
But you're going to be servicing others.
Yep.
As well.
That's right.
Okay.
And, you know, with all the technical abilities, you know, we're going to be building some solutions around making that an easier process, you know, both whether it be from the investment standpoint or from the servicing standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
We've got some great things that are in the works, and I just can't say too much about it right now.
Okay.
There comes a point where you have to just stop talking. But, you know, we're really excited. And so you're always
about the offshore.
You're always trying to get where my passions are.
And, yeah, I am.
Yeah, that's where it is.
Okay.
For me.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the reason, if you can comment on this, for thinking of other sources of servicing is cost. Is that what you're thinking about?
A bit. There's a bit of that component. Okay. Another element in play is, you know, the relevant population that's there is very enthusiastic.
Okay.
And, you know, for me, it's closer than going to New York City.
Okay. Okay.
So, yeah, I've spent quite a bit of time down in Central America
and
worked with a new group that we've been building now for probably 3 or 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going fantastic. Actually, it was already in existence prior to that, but we've changed its MO, and now that is an Oliphant facility.
Okay. You mentioned the word a couple times, diversify. So you're getting into other asset classes besides the traditional credit card, auto?
I'll say a little bit of that. I meant more of the diversity of the activity is, you know, being the master servicer.
Okay.
And, you know, the strategic group and managing all the legal act outsourcing and that type of thing.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, sort of a soup to nuts solution. We're going to put a lot of time and resources around everything from auditing to mm-hmm. skip tracing to you name it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to put that to better use by availing that to other people.
Let's talk about Beam for a few minutes, because that's the other kind of hat that you wear, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you're founder, and I don't know if you are you still CEO of Beam or
I don't know. Did I forget if I voted myself in?
Tom Moore is running it day to day, but I'm sure that you're still are driving the vision for Beam software. And, you know, truth be told, we're one of your clients. We love Beam. It's simple, and you know, I think you developed Beam for your own purposes, right? You learned from debt buying that there were certain tools and functions that had to be automated. I think that's how you got the idea for Beam, right?
That's right.
And then you commercialized it. So could you comment a little bit now, again, how that evolved and then what your future vision is for Beam software?
Yeah. Well, this is sort of a metaphor to elephants, I guess. You know, elephants have a gestation period that's more than a year, I think. And Beam was one of those things.
Okay.
I was trying to draw a parallel with elephant and Oliphant.
Yeah, I was trying to get that. Is there a message there?
Yeah, the message was the gestation period was about 4 years.
4 years.
From formation. And it started out as a paper. I started drafting in the Las Vegas airport 1 year, and I just kept pecking at it, and eventually it became a whole bunch of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought this is ripe enough. And I started working with one of my development pals, and we would do some prototyping, what we'd call a hollow app, and that's really what launched it. And so we put some money behind it, brought in some of the greatest developers that had built financial software. Mm-hmm. Jerry Rubin and his son Ken and a few other people.
Yeah, I remember him.
And just brilliant. I had more fun with those guys back in that period of time. Mm-hmm. Nobody was more fun than Jerry and mm-hmm. brainstorming some of these things and having pieces of paper on the wall and mm-hmm. working out a process and going through every mm-hmm. little detail of it. Mm-hmm. And I learned a lot from him too. He's a very, very dynamic guy. And so that was really the birth of it. Beam comes out around April of 07, you know, we finally had our first code base that was ready for prime time. And, mm-hmm. and we released it just to Olifant, and that's the way it was mm-hmm. for about a year as mm-hmm. we worked through a lot of things. But the idea was to simplify a lot of the interoperative things, from outsourcing to skip tracing, all the integrated, what we call provisioners, mm-hmm. From skip tracing and all the other information that you pull from the outside and getting it into your database and having a good clean set of records on all that.
Right. What differentiates Beam from your competition?
The fact that I built it. No. okay. A lot of things. I mean, Beam does a lot of things that a lot of other software has never even considered because unlike, some of the traditional old guard softwares that are out there, we didn't start with the contingency agency in mind. We started more with the debt purchasing and investment management in mind. Mm-hmm. That accounting can get a little bit interesting mm-hmm. as you try to reconcile basis and face value mm-hmm. To create a portfolio balance sheet is what we call it. Mm-hmm. So a lot of that stuff exists in Beam and was kind of the initial part of the mm-hmm. The drive behind what we were assembling, mm-hmm. and then the collection system came on top of that, mm-hmm. and it's just very unique. Mm-hmm. And some of the stuff we're doing now is we've got some new talent both here and overseas. We're doing some great stuff that we're very excited about.
Okay.
And it
can
is.
Can you comment on what that stuff is that's coming down the road, and
I can't.
What your Beam clients can look forward to?
I'm thinking.
Well, you're still investing in Beam, and your strategy is, I guess, to continue to make it easy to use, cost effective, and
yes.
How about integration of information? Is that still a priority on how the user of Beam can draw down more data in the process?
Yeah, we want to give more tools to making the operations. Giving the manager more enterprise sorts
right.
of tools
right.
to make them as efficient as possible.
Okay.
So lots of speed enhancements are in the works even now, but okay. some whole new dimensions to the program are also in the works.
Okay.
And so, as you work on a project like this, there's a lot of facets to it uh-huh. and you do one at a time, but you it's sort of like the guys laying the Continental Railroad. You got to make sure they meet in the middle.
Okay. I was hoping maybe we could get you to give us a scoop on, a new model of Beam that's coming that we could announce today.
Yeah.
Some headlines for the industry, Bob.
Yeah, my guys would kill me if I did that today.
Okay.
So
okay.
I'm gonna just very politely hold back.
Okay. Yeah. Well, Beam, but you said, I guess, everything is like an elephant. It's got a year gestation. So I'm assuming what you're working on is going to be out in another year. This is.
I would say so, yeah.
Okay. And how many customers do you have now, Beam?
Oh, boy. 9-10 million?
No, seriously, what?
I would say in the hundreds.
In the hundreds, okay.
Yeah.
All right, terrific.
Yeah.
Okay. Very good. So any other comments for our friends here that are listening on kind of the evolution of Olifant and, how you're building it and what you're, what we should look for in the future as Olifant, kind of a leader in the debt buying space?
Look for us to not be the same as we are today.
Okay.
We can never be that.
In terms of volume or asset classes?
In terms of anything. I mean, this is
Your underwriting process, is that changing, evolving? Or?
Yes, I would say so. Only because the consumer himself is changing.
Okay.
So, yeah, we've had to, adjust our expectations and how we deal with people. Always the one constant is that we've always had a very pro-consumer mm-hmm. response. And, part of the fun in my last couple of months is I've had the personal opportunity to go and get involved in some of the training. And I've really had a lot of fun doing it. And, I think the trouble that a new agent has with getting their head in this business is all the framework stuff, we call it. The things
what
they
does
have
that mean,
to say.
Framework stuff.
The identification, the validation of the identity, the mini Miranda, Okay. You know, and I always joked, oh, thank God we got rid of the Maxi Miranda.
Okay.
Because that was really long.
Okay.
but, you know, we teach our people how to work with the framework.
Right.
Almost as a game. And we actually give them improvisational comedy training.
Okay.
As a way of innovating through a conversation in a friendly way.
Right.
And being accepting. And one of the things you learn as a as a stage actor is the presence of your other actors on the stage with you has to always be accepted, or else it just doesn't work. It falls apart. And the same thing is true.
The other actors on the stage have to be accepted.
Yeah, you know, there's a whole game that they play called Yes And. And so they throw you in a situation. They say, well, you're a brother and sister at the supermarket, and you're arguing over which flavor of Pop-Tarts to be buying.
Okay.
And every dialogue sentence has to start with yes and.
Okay.
You know, yes and, I'm going to get this one because blah, blah, blah. And
right.
You
right.
improvise the conversation. So we actually incorporated that into our training and had tremendous luck with it. And, it makes the training a little more lively, but you want them to think. You don't want them to be a robot and get caught. You want them
they
to
mean the collectors?
The agents, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And we teach them, absolutely, they're dealing with a person on the other end of the line
that
went through something that was probably, earth-shaking to them.
Mm-hmm.
Let's try to find out what it is, how long we got to wait. Let's give them the time they need and show them a little bit of empathy.
Mm-hmm.
And then this one collector who was having some trouble, I went and I sat next to her.
Right.
And I did a bunch of calls myself.
Uh-huh.
And I took a guy that was going to go file bankruptcy. He was so appreciative of the fact that we gave him the respect that he deserved as a veteran.
Right.
As a guy dealing with a bacterial infection in his teeth that was getting into his heart.
Mm-hmm.
He was going to the VA. I said, sir, we appreciate your service.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to hold this. You let me know when it's going to work for you.
Mm-hmm.
We'll give you the time of day. You don't have to worry about this.
Mm-hmm.
He was so grateful that we just gave him a respectful talk off. He said, I like you guys. I like how you operate. I'm going to pay you.
Mm-hmm.
And he started out with bankruptcy.
That's a great story. That's a great story. Now, let me digress for a second. Didn't you, as a hobby, weren't you doing, was it stand-up comedy or you were speaking on stage? Was that your brother?
No, that was me. Well, my brother does that too.
Yeah.
My brother does, he does the dueling piano bars down in, if you're in Austin, Texas.
Right, right.
And you find yourself at Pete's on a Wednesday night, that might be him up on the stage. But he does that.
But you were doing some stage work too, right?
Well, yes, I was in an improvisational comedy class at the Florida Studio Theater in Sarasota, Florida.
What got you into that?
I don't know.
Uh huh.
I try to do different things.
We love to connect the dots here on Capital Cub Radio, and I guess I'm seeing and listening that. You know, not only are you, you know, a creative technologist, a creative debt buyer, but you also value the power of relationships and communication,
because
that's what you're doing when you're talking about the yes and, you know, teaching the collectors how to connect.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if there's something inside Bob Morris that, you know, you've got this natural interest in connections and communications, which, you know, whether it's with information technology or whether it's operations with your collectors, your agents.
I don't go into any of this with a preconception, but there's a great show, Michael, and it was on one of the Discovery Channels a few years ago where they took a quantum physicist and an artist and all these different avocations. They put them in a room and they gave them some kind of a physical puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
And they all approached it differently. But more often than not, it was the artist that would figure it out. So I'm a big believer in if you're caught in, if you feel like you're in a rut or you're just not advancing your thinking, you're doing the same thing over and over again, unplug everything, go hike the Appalachian Trail or take a flying lesson, do something that's just out of the blue different and get your head out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I find that when sometimes you do that accidentally, you know, you find yourself in a weird situation. You have other ideas, you know, change your environment if you need to come up with a new idea, but never be so linear as to say that, all right, I see some trouble ahead and I can't think my way through it. You just got to get your head out of it sometimes. I'm a big believer in that.
So it's constant personal renewal. It sounds like what you're talking about.
Yes, I would say that's a good word for it. Thank you for that. I'm going to use that.
Renewal, renovation, you know, you're constantly renewing, renovating your products and your vision. So, so speaking of vision going forward, we talked about Oliphant and Beam. What about the industry, you know, vision? And we now have a brand new administration that, you know, is led by, I call him a radical reformer here. what do you see coming down the road for our friends in the debt buying industry relative to either you know, regulation and even supply. And I know you're pretty bullish at Oliphant about your projections for spending this year. Share with our listeners what you see then coming in the next year or two on a macro industry level.
And I'll say next two or three years, you know, is my forward view. I mean, it's hard to do anything in 12 months.
Mm-hmm.
Although, you know, you got to give Trump credit where it's due. I mean, he is moving quickly on a number of fronts.
Mm-hmm.
I guess my design, you know, I understand the intent of CFPB.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times the spirit of these laws is well-intended, but it also had a lot of unintended consequences. And when you strangle a business or a number of industries all at once, you know, people take notice. And, you know, back, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, it was very easy, you know, and this is not a bad thing, people, but it was easier to get credit. Now, the fact that you can and can't manage it, that's another issue. But you know what? I'll guarantee you when somebody has a charge-off event and they're running into troubled waters ahead, it's that credit card that opened to buy that they have available to them that gets them from one side to the other initially, not the government services. Those take a while to come online if you have to file for welfare. And a lot of those dollars never get collected. So when you look at the commoditization of consumer credit cards as it existed, you know, in the late 90s, in order for those days to come back, you know, it's got to be a totally different environment. But they seem to be, all of those aggregates are on the uptick these days, the Federal Reserve's G19 release. And it seems like, you know, as that number grows, this business has always paralleled that growth. And so that's the basis of my prediction is that it's always made sense. So banks are going to want to do it as long as they, you know, it's an allowed process. And the basis for doing it is more compelling now than it used to be because, and the total number of, or the total amount of aggregate consumer non-mortgage debt is huge.
So do you think the middle market will come back, or do you think the, you know, the consolidation that occurred because of the shrinkage of the supply of consumer debt and the huge regulation, that kind of put a lot of them out of business, do you think some middle market companies can still make it, or?
Well, the market pulled back because of the regulations, not because of the shortage of debt. There's plenty of charge-offs out there. And in fact, after the mortgage crash, you know, you charge-offs went up to 10-11%. I mean, the portfolios saw, you know, huge write-offs. But no, I think that, I think the secondary market could come back under the
Even with the resale restriction?
With the seller's ability to control those down sales, downstream sales, with a technology platform behind it, I think that could happen, and I've said as much to even the CFPB.
The two asset classes where we see growth are marketplace lending. You know, the online lenders. We've seen a lot there. Is that a asset class that Oliphant is exploring?
Continuously.
Okay.
Yes.
So that's a growth opportunity.
It is.
What about, we call it the kind of the high APR consumer installment loan segment, which now a lot of the payday lenders have kind of morphed into, and we're hearing that, we're seeing actually the volumes there are getting significant and the prices are more and more attractive. Is that an area that you're looking at also?
Or? We have seen some of those files. You know, we haven't gotten any of them yet, but we've seen some of them. You know, I've traditionally stayed away from the products that target the subprime.
Right.
Yeah. I've never bought a payday file in my life.
So do you think that these high APR consumer installment loans, does that bear reputational risk as well or not?
It's not so much that. It's just not my preferred product, that's all.
Right.
Look, I mean, those loans occurred because there was a need.
Right.
And I don't think that any government or person should dictate who can borrow money from whom under any circumstances.
Right.
That's where I draw the line. I don't think my government needs to be that close.
Right. Right.
And I think that's what Trump is all about. I think that, you know, rules and regs are good. Let's operate honestly and fairly and let's disclose it. But we've had Reg Z for how many years now? We didn't need a bunch more, or maybe not that many more.
Right.
What I'd like to see from our government service people is more of a greater clarity to how we operate. And I think if one thing could come out of the next few years, I'd love to see true safe harbor in this business.
Right.
True safe harbor, things that you can say and not say. And
yep.
Give us absolute absolutes for the first time.
Well, Bob, this has been a really interesting discussion today. It just reminded me, you know, how important the data is, the technology, but also in Oliphant, you know, the huge network of creditor relationships you've got, and I think that's what's driving your very optimistic expectations this year of spending, plus the focus on people and communication and what you're doing inside Oliphant. It's a wonderful thing. And as you expand your servicing function and that training and personal development and the focus on the consumer, not the debtor, it's wonderful. We're really impressed with how far Oliphant has come. And are there any kind of parting words of wisdom for our listeners as we embark here on an exciting 2017?
All I can say is treat people well, and that generally keeps you out of trouble.
Keep people well, and that keeps you out of trouble. That's a wonderful, very sage advice for us and all of our listeners. So anyway, thank you very much, Bob Morris, founder of Oliphant and Beam Software, for being with us.
Thank you, Michael.
Okay.
Been a pleasure.
We want to thank you for listening to this special episode of the Capital Club Radio Show, with your host, Michael Flock, and his guests live from the 2017 DBA International Conference at the Aria Resort Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas. Made possible in part by Flock Specialty Finance, more than a transaction. For more info, visit flockfinance.com. To listen to a rebroadcast and more episodes, visit capitalclubradio.com.